Lowe's knows that no matter your paint project, saving is at the top of your list. That's why when you shop today, you can buy one, get one free select Valspar and HGTV Home by Sherwin-Williams one-coat coverage interior paints via rebate. Shop these deals in-store or online today at Lowe's. We help, you save. Rebate in form of Visa gift card equal to 100% off the second eligible item purchased before or after applicable discounts, if any. See details. Offer ends 7/9.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets. My name is Paul Hill, and by popular demand, I'm delighted again to be able to host the September Macro Investing Masterclass with three distinguished capital markets experts, namely Chris Watling, CEO at Longview Economics, Edmund Shing, CIO at BNP Paribas Wealth Management, and Patrick Armstrong, CIO at Plumini Wealth. So welcome, gents.
Hi there.
Good morning. For having us.
Yeah, well, lots been happening since we last spoke, and there's a ton of key macro and economic information coming out later this week, not least tomorrow's Federal Reserve interest rate decision alongside the UK CPI. And then I think later in the week, we also have decisions by the Bank of England and the Bank of Japan. So maybe we can start there, Chris. I've really been scratching my head. Where are we on the economic cycle? You have these sort of experts saying we're late cycle, but actually most people now have written off a recession after 15 years since the last one. So where are we? What's your latest thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's funny, you're right. The Wall Street wizards, as they call them, have changed from recession call earlier this year to soft landing. That's now the consensus. It's all been licked and all been beaten. The good news is I think inflation is beaten, basically, and we can stop hiking rates. So if you really think about what drives inflation, whether it's monetary or inflation expectations, or some people talk about the labour market, I think all the forward-looking indicators of that say whatever your inflation view as to the driver, it's licked. So that's the good news. But the bad news is I'm afraid there's over-tightening. And if you look around the world, there's so much evidence of it. You have a damaged Chinese economy. You have a very damaged European economy that's probably in recession now. I was just in Northern Europe in the last couple of weeks, and every country I went to is the same story. Construction's dead. No one's borrowing any money. Money's too tight. There's no buyers of commercial resi, et cetera. And then even in the States where there's an odd bright spot, but in reality, I think it's looking tough and we're working our way towards recession and the labor market is starting to go. So, you know, we are late cycle. The stock market is behaving as if we're late cycle. And, I think it's pretty clear. So, yes, inflation's licked and beaten. Great news. Bad news, I'm afraid, is the recession is coming.
And then Patrick, if Chris is right and we are late cycle, is the stock market really showing us that it is? I mean, you've got the US at sort of like a PE ratio of roughly about 19 forward. But obviously the UK and Europe are seem very undervalued compared to historical norms. What's sort of your latest view in the terms of equities going forward? Because the stock market and the economy are obviously two different things.
So I'm not bearish on equities. I think equities are pretty fairly priced. They're expensive in the US, driven by the multiples the mega cap techs are trading at. They're cheap in Europe and Japan, but for good reason. I think the US, you can make a case for a soft landing, plausible to call it Goldilocks. In Europe, it's anything but Goldilocks. So you've got almost no growth in Europe. In the US, it's growing probably this year at close to potential at 2%. Inflation's on the downward trend in the US, but the weak euro, the high oil prices, inflation might prove to be a little bit stickier in Europe. So you've got maybe the stagflation in Europe, even where inflation just continues if the ECB can't hike anymore because of a weak economy. But the weak euro, the higher commodity prices, you may have a bit more persistent inflation in Europe despite a weak demand backdrop. In our multi-asset portfolios, the traditional ones, my cautious strategy, I've got 31% equities right now versus a 35 neutral. In our balance, we're at 46 equities versus a 50 neutral. So I've not made big moves, but I've moved slightly underweight equities in these strategies.
So Patrick, if you're suddenly like less than 40% into equities, where are you putting all your money? Is it bonds and is it cash?
Well, you know, my cluster strategy, 65% neutral, would be in bonds, and it's mostly in bonds. Short duration bank bonds, I think, are almost a risk-free way to get a 6% yield. A JP Morgan bond, two-year duration, you get a 6% yield on, and there's no scenario JP Morgan's going to default on their senior bonds in the next 2 years. So the yield curve entices you to the front end, just with the shape of it, the inversion. Bank debt bonds from AA rated banks are giving you higher yields than BBB industrials, just because people have seen what's happened to Credit Suisse. 2008 still in their minds, but that's a nice yield pickup where you're going to beat inflation with a 6% handsomely. And I've actually added duration recently, but not through conventional bonds, but through TIPS. A real yield on a 10-year TIP is 2% right now. And I think that's attractive. I agree with Chris that inflation is definitely on a downward trajectory. You probably even starting to see some demand slow down. But populism is still the winning policy in governments. And if there's any trouble, it's cutting taxes, spend more, and eventually that's going to lead to a monetization strategy. That's why I want the inflation protection in my duration. So I lock in 2% on whatever inflation is. If there's no inflation, I get a 2% real return. If there is inflation, I'm hedged against that. So I'm skewed between TIPS at the long end and short duration banks at the front end.
Wow, that certainly sounds a pretty sort of well balanced sort of little portfolio. Mm. Now, Edmund, what's your sort of lady view? I know you've been relatively more optimistic in terms of the future, but are you sort of like seeing the alternative now in fixed income as well rather than equities?
We have done for some time. I think we're very much with Patrick there. Our struggle is to get our clients to move into bonds at all, because they're very happy with cash yields. I mean, look, it depends where you're coming from. What is your expectation? What are you happy with? If you're happy with 4 or 5%, 4% in Europe, 5% in the US, well, why would you do anything other than cash? Because you can achieve 5% plus in money market funds and dollars. You can achieve close enough to 4% on a term deposit or something similar in euros. And of course, in pounds, you're under 5% again. You know, there are money market funds that can give you close to 5%. So, and I notice National Savings and Investments, the UK government, offer a one-year fixed rate at 6.2% for those of you who are brave enough to go with them online. My parents, unfortunately, it's a struggle. As soon as I said the word online, they said, no, not doing that. But for those of you who are not technophobes, 6.2% from the government. Well, I mean, why would I buy government gilt for a year when I can have 6.2% from the government via their online site? So, I mean, I can't imagine there'd be many people not that unhappy with 6.2% at the moment.
And so Chris, just coming full circle, why is the US on a sort of like a 19, 20 times PE? The UK is on, I don't know, 11 or sort of like 10 or 11, and Europe's probably on 12 or 13. Why the big discrepancy in valuations? And also, why has had so many flows into US equities if you do have now this alternative of bonds of over 5%?
Well, of course, really, there's seven stocks that dominate the US market cap. So the Magnificent Seven that Patrick was talking about earlier account for actually about a seventh of the world's entire stock market capitalization. And there are even more of the US capitalization. I mean, the US is sort of 60, 65% of global market cap at the moment. So these seven stocks are valued on very high PE ratios. So, I mean, in general, on average over time, if you look over history, the US PE ratio is about three PE points higher than the UK anyway, because it's a better run. A lot of the companies are better run. They got higher returns on equities. But really, it's the dominance of tech, and that's what's been driving the flows. And actually, it's another reason we look late cycle. I mean, when the retail guys get heavily involved in trading stocks, that's generally a sign you're late cycle. And I think that's where we're at the moment. I think what's most fascinating about those Magnificent Seven is NVIDIA is, of course, a terrific company. I don't follow companies, as you know, but we all know it's a terrific company. It's discovered a new terrific chip that it last November that it launched in terms of AI, and that drove the stock higher. But on its earnings announcement a few weeks ago, the stock gapped up on the announcement. They were blowout earnings, absolutely fantastic, way above the really high expectations. And then the stock promptly sold off for the next few weeks. And it's down something between 10 and 15% from that earnings announcement. So that is telling you that everyone's bought it. The whole world's in. You know, everyone's all in. And I think that's the theme with US equities as well. Name me someone on the planet who doesn't know about the Magnificent Seven. There ain't no one. There's no one. I mean, I think even my grandmother, if she were alive, would tell me about NVIDIA today. So, you know, it's like Charlie Munger said, you know, price is what you pay, value is what you get. And these stocks are very expensive and they've become fashionable. And when a stock becomes fashionable, it generally tells you that it's sort of time is almost up. So in terms of leadership of the market, not in terms of being a good company. So that's why the US is expensive. The amount of tech in the UK market, I think it's sub 1% of the market cap. The amount of tech in Europe is not dissimilar to that number. So it's to do with the sector weightings and so on.
Yeah, well, I think you're right on NVIDIA. It is a sort of the poster child, the Yul Brynner, isn't it, of the Magnificent Seven, if you remember the film or the whatever it is. Now, Patrick, how are you treating tech? Because you've obviously been cautious in terms of which you've selected, but you've done pretty well out of it. Are you in NVIDIA or even ARM, or are you sort of like going towards your Microsoft and your Googles?
So I own Google, I own Apple, I don't own NVIDIA or Tesla or Meta this year, unfortunately. They're all up 150 to 200%. For clients who come to me who really want to own big cap growth, which you can understand why they want to, what I've been doing is telling them sell puts right now. And you can get paid a 12% yield while you wait. If the market comes back to you, you own stocks you wanted to own anyway at discounted values. So NVIDIA is at 430. We've been selling 9 month put options on it at 330. And you're doing this across the range. It's yielding about 12% for the strategy because you pick up 5% from free from the treasury, sell about 6% in premiums on these great stocks where the only real issue is the multiple they trade at. So you're mitigating the really expensive multiples. You're getting paid a premium to do it. If the market runs away from you, you're not going to be too upset because you've collected that 12%. If the market comes back, these are stocks you wanted to own anyway, and you've done it cheaper than where they're trading, and you've picked up the premium. So I think that's a nice way to play expensive companies. It mitigates the valuations, and it's not the business models. It's not the economy, the worry with these companies. It really is the multiple.
Mm. How are you playing tech, Edmund? Because obviously with your AI hat on, you've got a really good detailed insight into been driving the sort of the stellar performance.
Yeah, but Paul, I would exactly echo what Chris said about glamour stocks, you know, and the academic research is very clear on this. Glamour stocks do get overvalued. And when the retail investors piling into these glamour stocks, that's when the smart money should be exiting. I exited too early, to be honest. We have been cautious on US large cap tech for most of this year. So we've missed, you know, you could argue we've missed a lot of the run up. But again, if you just bear in mind a slightly longer span of performance, everyone's so focused on this year to date since January. But if you include 2022 and say, okay, from the beginning of 2022, how have stocks done? Well, the NASDAQ is down 11%. Okay. Over the 1 and a bit years, nearly 2 years. So yeah, it looks great this year, but it looked horrible last year. And again, we have to keep that in mind as well. How many people were smart enough to have avoided it all of last year and then bought it on the 1st of January this year? Not so many, I would wager.
Yeah.
So it looks spectacular. And as Patrick said, there have been spectacular gains in some of these stocks, glamour stocks, but I would be incredibly nervous now. And our advice is similar to Patrick's. It's really to look elsewhere or to use structured products, not just to buy these stocks on a naked basis at these very high valuations, because, yeah, you know, there's a lot of expected growth priced in at these very high valuations today, and the risk of disappointment is correspondingly relatively high.
Yeah, I think you all raised brilliant points there, particularly in terms of the big mega cap tech. Because if you had NVIDIA blowing the numbers out and it exceeding expectations, and its share prices fall, that says to me that they've reached a sort of fairly stretched levels. And I guess the AI play will actually the rubber will have to hit the road. It's probably sometime next year or late this year that's going to start generating some actual results, because it's all been multiple expansion.
Well, exactly. Where's the money? There will be a show us the money moment for AI, like with any mega trend. And I think maybe the smart way, Paul, to play that would rather be to look at sectors that will benefit from AI, as opposed to the NVIDIAs of this world, these so-called enablers, because we're not quite sure who the real long-term winners are going to be. But we can be pretty sure, for instance, that the healthcare sector is going to benefit enormously from innovation and diagnostics in new treatments and finding new drug candidates from the applications of AI. So you could sort of play it that way, as I said, instead of buying the NVIDIAs of this world.
Yeah. Now I'm just switching something. Chris, in terms of sort of like, you know, just broadly in terms of commodities and China, how are you seeing that sort of like ecosystem playing out? Because we've really got a bit of a slowdown in the first half, which nobody expected in China. But now they do seem to be sort of like thinking about stimulating.
Yeah, great question. I mean, the thing about China is it's clearly got a bursting housing bubble. And, you know, and the conversation about how important housing is to China has been going on for several years. And the estimates that are sensible are it's about 30% of GDP direct or indirectly affected by what goes on in real estate. So when you burst a bubble, you can't just sort of throw bits and pieces of stimulus at it. That's kind of what they've done in the last few weeks. You've had a bit of cuts to mortgage rates. You had some cuts to the RRR last week. There are bits and pieces, but they haven't really come out with a big bazooka. And I think what you need in China is you really need a big policy bazooka to offset this confidence that's crashed in the economy as a result of housing. And if you think about it, there's all this cash in bank accounts, but the people who have cash in bank accounts in China are the people who own houses. And they're also the people whose kids are unemployed. Youth unemployment is at sort of record 21%. They stopped publishing it now because they're so uncomfortable with the number. Which actually, if you look at the number of stats they stopped publishing in China, it's frightening. It's sort of halved in the last few years. So China is a real issue. And actually, I think this is really interesting because people say, is the West going to export inflation to China? As I said, I think inflation is largely licked in the West anyway. Or is China going to export deflation to the rest of the world? And I think we're much more likely to get the latter one. And if they don't have a big policy bazooka, what's really interesting about China is where's the release valve? And the obvious release valve is the currency. And of course, if their currency does weaken significantly, I know they're trying to defend it, but if it does weaken significantly, then of course, you export a lot of deflation to the West. So it's really, really important for the whole Western story. And it's also very important, of course, for China. But yeah, I think China's got some real challenges here. And doesn't seem like they want to do a big policy response. And that's the key question that you've got to ask yourself and think about.
Mm. And in that absence, Patrick, of a big sort of like bazooka, et cetera, in China, what's your view of sort of commodities and mining stocks and likewise big oil? Because, you know, the oil price is steadily ticking up above 90 and people are getting worried that whether that's going to have knock-on effects into inflation. How are you sort of playing this area? Because the valuations are extremely low if you look at historical prices, but it's that E. Where's the E going to be going forward?
Yeah, coming into the fourth quarter, healthcare and energy were my preferred equity sectors, and it's because year-to-date they were up pretty much zero while the market's up 15%. And there's going to be an extra million barrels of oil consumed by the time we get to February versus where we are now every single day with pretty subdued economic growth, but with growth coming out of China that's way below what people forecast, but still aggregate growth. Energy intensity in Asia, it's outstripping growth in the Western world. It's going to be more demand. There's more consumption. And production is pretty much capped, except for OPEC. So OPEC's got to get rid of the cuts to meet the growing demand, or they let prices rise. So I'm not sure that energy prices are going to rise from here, but I do think they can stay at elevated levels, which is incredibly powerful backdrop for oil and gas companies that buy back shares, pay dividends, pay down debt. And they've been ignored this year because everyone's been worried about this recession that's just around the corner. And I do think just the share buybacks, the dividends, the cash flows being produced are going to entice investors away from some of the more expensive stocks. It's a sector that comes with risk. If you're scared about the recession, it's not a good time to buy oil. But in my view, the U.S. weathers the recessionary fears until something shocks the employment backdrop. I do think we stay in a subdued, positive growth environment, and that's going to be very positive for energy stocks. On the mining companies, we don't own any long. We're short a few in the short portfolio. The supply-demand fundamentals across metals just aren't as compelling as they are for oil for me, because you don't have an OPEC swing factor that's really artificially curtailed supply. So I prefer energy to mining right now.
Right. What's your view, Edmund? Are these plays, are they value plays or the value traps?
The oil companies?
Well, both the mining and the sort of, I know you're positive on copper in particular and uranium, yeah, but in terms of start, let's start with the oil plays, the likes of BP and Shell and Total and people like that.
Well, I think, yeah, what I would say is that sustainability plays a big role here, and obviously a bigger role in Europe perhaps than in the US, where the pressure is higher. So you have seen, you know, companies like BP and Shell and Total pivoting more towards, you know, sustainable energy. So taking the profits they make from oil and then reinvesting some of those into more renewable energies. Now, clearly they've been penalized for that, because quite rightly, I think investors say, well, the return on investment on renewable energy is likely to be much lower than it is on oil. However, because of the ESG concerns and the push towards ESG, and you know, we at BNP are also part of that, we definitely lean very much towards sustainable, a more sustainable future. Having said that, as Patrick had said, you know, oil demand continues to grow. So we also have to be somewhat realistic here, that oil demand is not going down. Oil supply is somewhat constrained. OPEC in the short term are constraining, well, Saudi Arabia and Russia principally. But the rest of OPEC are also struggling to even meet the current quotas. Forget the quota cuts. They can't meet the quotas as they are today. Just aren't making it. They're about 1 million barrels a day short. So instead of producing 36 million barrels a day, they're actually producing more like 35 in a bit. And on top of that, we have to remember, again, the other element of the supply side is the US, which, of course, has become a huge producer. But shale oil production has actually been on the decline 3 months in a row.
I thought it was a peak production, actually.
Yeah, so the problem is the US can't pick up the slack because they're having their own problems. And what you're finding, interestingly, with new shale oil wells being drilled is that actually they're producing a lot more gas. So the balance between oil and gas is much more gas and a lot less oil. So particularly, you know, when you think about oil, forget the gas, really, because there's plenty of gas in the US. When you think about the oil, they're not producing as much as they used to, right? They're not putting in place lots and lots of rigs to drill lots of holes in the ground to find more oil. So rig count is actually not very high. So all of that means to me that if oil demand on the one hand is going up and oil supply remain constrained, and OPEC plus, particularly Saudi Arabia and Russia, don't do much about there to increase where they are in terms of production, I think, yeah, oil stays at easily at 95 on Brent. Probably doesn't go much higher, as Patrick said. I would agree with that. But I think they're very comfortable. They're extremely profitable at 95. Everyone's happy at 95, 90 to 95. And on top of that, the integrated oil companies benefit from a second tailwind, which, of course, is refining margins remain well above historic averages. So again, we are seeing squeeze on, for instance, diesel supply. And you need diesel not just for obviously cars, but think about heavy transportation, lorries, logistics, ships, and you know the list goes on. You'll need a lot of diesel, and by the way, they'll also be competing with heating oil demand in the US as we come into the winter yet again. So all of that suggests to me refining margins stay high. Integrated oil companies should therefore remain extremely profitable, and as we said, dividends, share buybacks, well supported, and probably continued debt repayment. So on a sort of shareholder return basis, they do look at very attractive at the moment and at low valuation. And there's a big valuation gap, by the way, between integrated oil companies in Europe versus the US versus the names such as ExxonMobil and Chevron Texaco. Mm. You know, these things trade 11 times, Europe more like 7 times. Mm. So there is maybe a bit of a, you know, there could be a bit of a valuation catch up as well.
Yeah, and they pay shed loads of dividends, don't they?
Exactly.
Yeah. Now, Chris, in terms of sort of like if we do going to get sort of a firm oil price going forward, how does that translate into inflation, which has been coming down quite rapidly, but inflation going forward, and also the sort of the context of central banks reducing interest rates, the assumption they're going to do that for next year, and then also sort of like just top level, how it sort of like if interest rates stay higher for longer, what that means for bank balance sheets, because that was the epicenter of the problem at the start of sort of March, April time.
Ton of very good questions. I mean, clearly if the oil price stays high and goes higher from here, it starts feeding into inflation, absolutely. And often tends to feed into inflation expectations. There's normally a very good correlation between sort of one and three year inflation expectations and the oil price and or implied inflation within the bond market. In fact, that correlation unusually has broken down in the last few months, but you would have thought it might reassert itself. So, yeah, I mean, that would be a concern. Powell and Lagarde, they're all keen to stay high for longer. It's higher for longer is kind of the mantra now. Personally, I don't believe it. I think what the oil price will do is just squeeze the economy, squeeze the consumer, and add to the recessionary dynamic that we see brewing in the system. So I don't think oil price is going to stay up here for that long. I think I'd look to buy oil at 70 again. I suspect we'll get a retest of that level. That was a big level on Brent, 70, 71, from which we've rallied pretty hard. But, you know, I accept I may be wrong. Oil is often a late cycle play, which is, I think, what we've essentially all been alluding to. We remember 2008 with the oil price rallying into the middle of 08. I think, I can't remember, they got 130, 140, something like that. So, yeah, I mean, higher oil price, if it happens, means higher for longer, means more pressure on banks' balance sheets, as you say. If you look at the US mid-tier banking system, I mean, basically, if you think of a normal regional bank, is essentially it takes deposits, makes loans and buys government debt and MBS and things like that. And it's under pressure on every area of its balance sheet because interest rates are too high. So if you leave them up there for even longer, it's a real challenge. I was looking at some of the monetary metrics this morning. Money supply is contracting pretty much everywhere in the West, pretty much in every measure of money supply that you can find. And that is not a good sign for the economy over the next 6 to 12 months. It's also another good way of explaining why a high oil price actually, instead of being inflationary, when there's no money being created, is more likely to be deflationary because it'll bite on the consumer's spending power. So, yeah, I think, I agree with everyone that oil sector is attractive on a 2 to 5 year view. I just think you've got to get through the recession and the response of the oil price to that recession first. But yeah, high oil prices, it's not good news, really.
Yeah. Yeah, high prices are a good solution, aren't they, for high prices, as everybody says, commodity and oil. Now, Patrick, in terms of what's your sort of view on the banks? I mean, are we going to start seeing some of the sort of the merchant banks benefited, the likes of BNP and Goldman's and people like that, given that the IPO cycle may be coming back with the success last week of Arm and a few others coming onto the markets?
Perhaps. Trading revenues is a bigger swing factor for them, and those are harder to predict. If you like banks, I just am attracted to the bonds. The banks are cheap. They're paying dividends. I don't know if they're going to get cheaper, but the bonds I'm just so comfortable with. So for me, the way to play banks, I don't think there's massive upside. You're probably targeting the yield and the value, and you're going to get very similar returns from the bond with almost no risk. So I'm skewed towards the short end on senior investment grade.
And you're going into sort of ultra high grade, just sticking with the JP Morgans of this world.
Yeah, so senior unsubordinated debt is where I'm going. Nothing too sexy. I actually own some Cocos as well at the fringes.
Which banks? I'm amazed after Credit Suisse.
I own just an ETF. I got a Wisdom Tree Coco 81 ETF, so diversified. But you get a yield premium there, but that comes with risk, obviously, whereas the short end senior, I don't think there is any risk.
Right. What about you, Edmund, in terms of bonds and fixed income? Where are you sort of like looking at? Are you looking at short or long or sovereign or corporate?
Yeah, short to medium grade? Term. There's no need to go long-term sovereign. I mean, the only time you go long-term sovereign really is if you think there's a deep recession coming. We don't. We think there's a recession coming in the US, but not a deep one, pretty shallow one. So that's not really going to do huge damage. There's huge damage that would want you to be going very long, long-dated bonds. So short to medium maturity, more investment-grade corporate than sovereign, to be honest with you, although we do like US tips. So we agree with, I certainly would agree with Patrick, I like the inflation protection element because it's a good each-way bet, right? If we're wrong and inflation does rear its head again, then you're okay, right? If we're right and Chris is right and it comes down, you're still pretty okay, actually, because inflation probably isn't going to settle at 2. It'll settle probably at something over 2. You pick up 2 real yield plus the 2 plus on the inflation means you get 4 and a bit on a sovereign. That's not too bad. And you get a bit of a pickup if you play corporates as well. So you can get up to nearly near a 6 in dollars on IG corporate. And then even on things like agency bonds in the US, which are like government, but not quite government, you're actually getting quite a useful spread, which you, and if you look at those indices of agency bonds, you can get over 5% in dollars. Mm. And that's even without going as far as corporate. So there are plenty of places to find yield. I would agree with Patrick. I like bank bonds as well. And you don't need to go long duration. You could stay short duration. You can pick that up too. So there are, you know, we are basically in an environment which we haven't seen for 10 to 15 years, depending which market you look at, you know, whether you look at UK gilts or you look at corporate bonds or you look at bank bonds or agency bonds. We just have not seen this level of yield for 10 to 15 years, pretty much across the board. The biggest challenge is just to persuade people to get out of cash and move into the bonds to lock in those yields, because, you know, the reality is that if we're right and there's a bit of a recession coming, at the very least, activity is going to slow down a lot. At some point next year, central banks will be wanting to cut rates probably. Now, if they cut rates, then yeah, it's great if you're in cash. But remember, those cash yields will start to fall, right? Whereas if you buy your, if you buy into bonds now, you can fix that. Mm. So yeah, we're big, we really like fixing those yields now. Yeah. Because at some point next year, cash rates will start to fall. And then yeah, your deposits will not be as valuable as they are now.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's quite interesting, actually, because you do get the optionality benefit of holding cash. I mean, it's people like, you know, sort of like punters like me, we've gone stocks. Well, I've got about 30% now in cash, but no bonds, simply because it gives me that chance that when interest rates do come down, I can then move it quickly without the transaction costs of bonds. But yeah, no, I can absolutely understand.
But that makes sense for a dynamic investor like yourself, who's fairly active. So for an active investor, absolutely, the choice is going to be more between cash and stocks. But for, let's say, someone at retirement or someone who's looking for a steady income and doesn't want to be thinking too much about it and is not active, different. It's a completely different conversation.
Yeah, yeah. Now we're just turning again, or pivoting to the consumer here. Chris, what's your sort of latest here? Because we've had the US earnings season. And one thing which did come out was that the majority of the sort of the medium type sort of retailers disappointed. They were either hit by sort of like, you know, contracting margins or shrinkage. And it seems as though, what's your latest view? Because if you split it between the high end, the medium end, and the low end of consumers around the world.
Yeah, well, it's a stimulus cliff. You know, we're at the stimulus cliff, basically. And the cliff hits different time for different quartiles of income. So, you know, all that chat about excess savings in the US, we got up to $1.8 trillion in, I think, late 2020, early 2021. And if you look at the calculations of where we are now, we sort of do some fancy calculations. And you end up with it's basically running out about now. And then you split it by income quartile. As you mentioned, we've had quite a lot of retailers struggling in August. We had the lower income retail struggling earlier this year, Dollar Generals and the like. And we've even had some of the luxury good makers talk about the US being a bit tough. So, I think the labor market's tightening up, you know, around the world. The excess savings are basically run down. If you look at core household bank deposits in the US, they're below pre-pandemic trend relative to GDP. So there's lots of reasons, I think, to say, yeah, it's actually starting to look a little bit tougher out there. I know there are one or two bright spots and people point to them. But yeah, I mean, just look at the amount of lending, the amount of borrowing that's going on in this economy. It's essentially zero on the consumer side. Eurozone household borrowing is negative year-on-year growth. U.S. mortgage applications for purchases of new homes is at a 27-year low. UK mortgage lending, net mortgage lending is just above zero and has been below zero in the last couple of months. So the consumer is running out of road. We're hitting the cliff. And it's going to be quite interesting 6 months.
How are you playing the consumer, Patrick? Are you staying at the high end or you're avoiding the low end? How do you see it?
We've consumer stocks we've got. We own Amazon, so the mega cap one. That's a retailer. We own Hermes still. We sold LVMH earlier in the year. And we have Stellantis, which
is a animal health
stock. We're pretty much neutral in line with the benchmark. So we've got three stocks out of a 30 stock portfolio. It's probably about 10% of my portfolio in those consumer exposed stocks. Stellantis is up probably 40% year to date, and it's at 5x earnings. Amazon's up 40% year to date, and it's at 50 times earnings. I don't know which one I'd rather own here out of the two. I can see Stellantis suffering, but I can also see the multiple Amazons suffering from it. Amazon hasn't cleaned up a monopoly position, but I think they have a monopoly position in profitable online retail right now, almost, that all of its competitors are still not at that profit-making point, whereas Amazon has moved to making profits in the retailing part of its business. So cloud is still the engine for profitability, but on the retailing side of things, it is getting profitable now as well.
And just on that Stellantis, how do you see the UAW strike out in the States panning through on the sort of the OEM manufacturers? And likewise, the one area that a lot of people have sort of been scratching their head is how much exposure they have to auto loans. Do they still have that on their balance sheets, or have they shifted it off?
No, they still have it, and I think it's actually going to be a big issue for all companies, is wage costs, labor costs, unionization. It's a thing that profit margins are still near record high across the board, and wage inflation, I think, is going to prove to be sticky. It's still a relatively tight labor market. It's not maybe as tight as it was, but I think job seekers still have some pricing power. Unions have power in this environment, and I think it is going to cut into profit. So it is something to keep an eye on, and I don't think it's just going to be an auto thing. I think wage costs and lower profit margins are going to be an issue for equities potentially.
Right. Okay, and then Edmund, in terms of sort of broader, you know, investment themes you're looking at going forward, obviously you're still relatively positive, but going into fixed income. Is there any sort of like on the, you know, the secular growth you think are trading at reasonable sort of like multiples that people should have a good look at?
Well, yes, absolutely. I mean, I think there are, you know, the flip side of so much money going into the big seven mega caps in the US, you know, and that's on a global scale. You know, we have Asian clients who've been doing that and are very overweight, and Middle Eastern clients. And my challenge is to try to get them to diversify these portfolios out of these what have been very big winners for them. But the flip side of all of that sort of the sort of magnet of attraction of the mega cap stocks is that a lot of other stocks and a lot of other segments have been completely and utterly ignored, even within the stock market. I mean, if you look at mid and small caps, for instance, I mean, I only have to say UK small caps as a whole.
Yeah.
Now, yeah, there's good and bad in there, but no one
cares.
They give
me a nightmare, Edmund.
Just nobody cares, it seems. And there are some very good companies in there, but nobody cares. You know, it's like that at the moment. I mean, again, Japan's getting some traction, and you know, everyone keeps telling me, but it's gone so far already. But yeah, look at a 30-year chart. It did nothing for more than a couple of decades. And yeah, finally it's doing something, but for good reason. And still, Japan, and the problem with Japan for at least a European or a US-based investor is if you didn't currency hedge, at least half of what you gained on the stocks and local in the yen, you then lost on the yen itself, because of course the yen has been depreciating. So that's been rather, unless you were clever enough to buy an ETF that was currency hedged to avoid that drag, you've actually not benefited from the Japanese run up as much as you know Mrs. Watanabe would have, for instance. So yeah, you know, there's still that, and I still there is that to play for as well. I think there is more to go in Japan. I think it is an interesting indirect way if you do want to play China. For me, oil demand is the one way, or Japan is another way to play indirectly China without buying Chinese stocks. But you know, the profit improvements that we are seeing across a whole swathe of industries in Japan for the first time in a long time, partly through government pressure, partly through activist pressure, they're pointing the same way. Profitability is structurally going up. Returns to shareholders in terms of dividends and buybacks are going up. And that's actually, and probably the profit estimates are probably still a bit understated, if anything, for Japanese companies, because analysts are really bad at forecasting their profits. They basically just follow company guidance, and Japanese company guidance is famously extremely conservative. So again, it could be that the Japanese stocks are a bit cheaper than you think, because the estimates are still a bit too conservative.
Good. What about you, Chris? Where are you sort of the broad sort of opportunities are in sort of sectors and maybe countries or whatever?
Well, it kind of depends on your time frame, but I'd say in the short term, some of the defensive sectors are really cheap. And so that's a place to put some money, particularly if you think
utilities you're talking about.
And well, I'm more thinking of Staples, actually. Staples globally is about as almost as cheap as it ever gets relative to the market across the globe. So that sort of area, if you're thinking on a sort of 1 to 2 year basis, there is, I'm with Edward, there is tons of opportunity. And the quicker we get into this recession, the quicker that opportunity is to be pounced on. I was in Scandinavia last week talking to a mid-cap fund manager who's telling me that the underperformance of Scandinavian mid-caps relative to big caps is about as wide as it's ever been in the last year or two, which is a classic sign that you're late cycle. And that's everywhere. I mean, you can draw, we have this curve we draw of sort of 10,000 global stocks, and you organize it by PE ratios and draw a distribution curve. And the distribution curve is massively shifted to the left, which is basically telling you pretty much every stock is cheap if you believe the consensus earnings. So get into the recession, get through the defensive phase, and then it's going to be rich pickings, and the pickings are not going to be tech. They're going to be almost everything else. From small mid cap to cyclicals to energy to big cap banks, it's going to be a lot of fun.
And if you're right there, Chris, we're going to see a big reset on EPS expectations of the S&P 500 for next year, because it's been trending up over the last month and a half, and I think it's about 245, 6, 7, something like that at the moment, and that's a 10% increase on this year's expectations. That's going to be a major shock to a lot of investors, if you're right.
Yeah, and look, I mean, S&P consensus earnings basically follows what bond yields do. So, you know, bond yields have been moving higher. The data's been a bit better in the States, the sort of immediate data. And that, of course, is getting everyone excited about this soft landing debate. But if I'm right and we're going to get a recession, bond yields are going to be considerably lower. And so are the earnings estimate. But in the US, of course, you've got this dominance of those big cap tech that sort of distorts everything. And if you looked in other regions of the world, Europe's been a bit better. The rest of it hasn't really. So it's a mixed bag globally. And the US, I think, is just benefiting from a softer dollar the first 6 months of this year and a bit of a stronger economy. And as I said, they're coming to the stimulus cliff, which has got to be the next big buzzword, stimulus cliff. Let's get that into the mindset.
We have got general election in the UK probably late next year, and we have one obviously in November out in the States. So that may be a bit more extra stimulus. I can't see Biden wanting to have a reset, sort of choking off the economy.
Well, he won't get anything through Congress now. Nothing will go through in the next 12 months to that size, unless there's a proper recession.
Yeah. What about you, Patrick, in terms of sort of broad themes and how you're viewing it in terms of where you're putting your money for the next 12 to 18 month view?
So our view is things are pretty appropriately priced. Equities very slightly expensive. Bond yields probably enticing me enough that they're fair value now too. The U.S., I do think, continues to run a fiscal deficit without the new spending, that Infrastructure Act, all the spending's being pre-agreed, that's going to keep the U.S. running at a deficit. So that's going to continue to be a fiscal thrust. I don't think the Fed's going to upset the apple cart and provoke a spike up in unemployment, which would cause a recession. So I think the Fed's sitting on their hands now for the foreseeable future. BOE's got one more hike ahead of them. So it's not something where I'm pounding the table that something looks incredibly attractive or something looks ridiculously overexpensive. I like the oil. I like the healthcare because they've been laggards. The mega cap techs that are expensive, I'm still cautiously bullish on that. I'd sell the put options on them and own them if they got a little bit cheaper. So it's that kind of environment where you can eke out 7 to 12% returns without taking a lot of risk. And if you want to take no risk at all, you get the 6% for free right now. So I think that's actually a pretty reasonable backdrop for investors right now.
Okay, good. And then just finally, then just going around the table in terms of things to watch. Edmund, anything there that we should look out for? I mean, is there going to be a sort of major reset in the housing market at all? Because I've got UK prices going down, you know, year on year at the moment. Or the States has been pretty resilient, but I'm guessing European house prices, particularly out in Germany, are pretty toppy as well.
Well, they've been falling. I mean, quite clearly they've been falling. You know, you could basically just draw an inverse correlation between the rising cost of financing and of course falling house prices, because guess what, mortgage rates go up, you can't afford as much, and that's the same in whether it's in the US, Germany, UK, it doesn't matter where. Now, you know, there's always a delayed reaction in the property market because there's always this gap that appears between buyers and sellers because psychologically buyers aren't willing to pay the price. They know the market's falling. And of course, sellers are sort of unwilling to accept the reality that prices are falling. And they think, yeah, other prices may be falling, but I don't want my price to fall. And so it always takes 6 to 12 months for the two to become more closely aligned, for basically the sellers to accept reality. It's just like, you know, they have to suffer the long drawn out pain, you know, death by a thousand cuts before they finally accept the reality and drop their prices. And then we're sort of getting there. But there are some very strange things going on, because let's not forget that rental demand, on the other hand, is still incredibly strong. If you look in London, if I look in Paris, or I look in the US, you know, rents are very robust. And I know my kids have been looking for, you know, places to rent in London. It's extremely difficult. So again, this is also partly due to the change in regulations around buy to let, and then of course the tax implications, which have become a lot tougher in the UK. But you see this everywhere. You see this everywhere, that rental markets on the residential side are extremely robust. Because again, if people can't buy their first house, what do? They rent for longer. So the rental demand is very strong. So look, there is this reset of prices. I don't think it's a collapse, because again, you need a deep recession for that. You need, more importantly, unemployment to be going up a lot. When unemployment goes up, then the housing market takes a massive hit. Again, you can think about the early 90s when we had sky-high interest rates and unemployment rates that went up a lot in the UK. And that's the cocktail that that's property market can't stomach. But we're not there, I think. Okay. I think actually there'll be a recession in vacancies. I'm not so sure there'll be a big jump in unemployment rates, because companies, maybe they don't want to hire more people, but they seem quite content to hang on to their people and just try to make do with what they've got at the moment.
Yeah, labor hoarding. What about you, Chris? Any sort of like hidden ordinance at all in sort of private credit or the, I'm not sure, in sort of like PE world and in private equity, that essentially if you've got higher rates for longer, then their balance sheets, like some of the regional banks, are also going to be pretty stretched?
The dollar's fascinating, isn't it? The dollar's strengthening. That tells you that liquidity is tightening, and generally there's a good chance that something might blow up. There's a long list of possible candidates. Predicting which it might be is incredibly hard. I have to say there is so much to keep an eye on at the moment. You know, risks to our view, I think, are that maybe bond yields go to 5. There's a big chat about that, and part of that equation could be the oil price moving higher. And then if you look at the flip side, it looks to me like the unemployment rate in the UK and the US is starting to properly move up. I think that'll be fascinating. If you look at UK employment, over the last 3 months, it's been steadily going down. The number of people with jobs is going down, and the number of people unemployed in the UK and the US is going up. All the labour market indicators at the fringe are deteriorating. So I think, you know, watch the steepness of the yield curve, because yield curves steepen up into recessions. And that's what it tried to do in March, and the Fed offset it with their $400 billion of liquidity. Watch that yield curve. I think the 10s, 2s is going to have a massive insight into what's going on in the global economy, what's going on in the US, and the timing of moving into that recession. Because I think if we're right and there is one, the stock market has got to respond, and you're going to have another leg down in a bear market. So, yeah, it's such an interesting time for a macro guy.
It's painful, actually, at the coal face as a stock picker as well. So,
well, it is. Unless you're in 7 stocks, most of the rest of the world is painful.
Yeah.
Or unless you're doing those cunning trade. I love that trade Patrick's doing on Nvidia. I think that's a great way to do it.
Yeah.
But yeah.
What about you, Patrick, in terms of things to watch over the next sort of like, you know, few months that you're sort of like, you know, closely monitoring?
Well, China is going to play a big factor what they do. The stimulus they've done has been largely symbolic so far. I'm not sure how they're going to right the economy. But what they do, there's different ways they can do it. They've got some demographic issues. They've got unemployment issues. And the scary thing is war is an answer to some of those things potentially too, even. So I don't know how they go. I think that's going to be a big swing factor that's largely unpredictable. Going into the election years, I think that's going to provide a reasonable backdrop for the U.S. economy. So I don't think the U.S. economy falls into the recession. Recession is still plausible, obviously, but I actually think the U.S. can just keep kicking the can down the road, growing subtrend, but maybe avoiding that recession.
And I saw in the latest, there was a Citibank came out with their economic projections over the next 2 years, and they were saying that all the major areas were going to be I'm going to avoid a recession. Do you think that is actually possible? I mean, that's just like saying we haven't had a recession for 15 years and we're going to miss it again. And I mean, is that?
Well, hang on, Paul. Hang on. That's not exactly true. The COVID pandemic was a recession. It was a very bizarre recession.
I exclude that because it was 5 nanoseconds.
But yeah, yeah, exactly. You blinked and you missed it. But that still qualifies as a significant setback in economic activity. Yeah.
So Patrick, are we going to avoid this?
I think the US does. Europe and the UK are in such a precarious position already where there is no growth. Any hit basically does taunt that recession. But it was a year ago pretty much today that I said a soft landing was an impossibility. I wrote a little LinkedIn article about the Fed's got to choose inflation or recession. It's going to be impossible to engineer this middle ground. And circumstances have led to it where it's totally plausible now. Mm-hmm. Europe, again, I see scenarios where they can avoid it, but it could easily fall into it as well.
Yeah. Well, it's a bit like, I think it's the three bears. It's safe to go down the woods today, potentially. We'll find out anyway in the next few months. So thanks very much, guys, for all your terrific comments and look forward again in touching base in about a month's time.
Thank you.
Thank you. Fantastic. Bye.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.